The Offspring had been a punk band kicking around California since the late 80s. California had developed its own strand of punk, and members of The Offspring were just kids who loved Social Distortion, the Dead Kennedys, the Vandals, and the like. They played some shows, they did some demos, very normal band stuff. At the same time, Brett Gurewitz, the guitarist of Bad Religion, was expanding his independent label. That label, Epitaph, started as an outlet for Bad Religion. The bands from around that Brett liked were looking for a label, so he signed bands like NoFX and Pennywise and, later, The Offspring. The Offspring released their first album on Epitaph in 1992. But by the time of their 1994 album Smash, things had changed. Punk, especially that Californian punk, had snuck through the mainstream door that was opened by Nirvana and grunge. Bands like Green Day were chart toppers, and The Offspring were right behind them. The Offspring Smash featured a couple of big radio singles, Come On Out and Play and Self Esteem, but Epitaph were not a major label. They were an independent label. They didn't have offices around the world, and Epitaph didn't own CD pressing plants. Instead, what Epitaph relied on was a series of indie distributors. They all sort of worked independently. Some of them would cover a region like Europe or South America, or just one country like the UK. For The Offspring and the Smash album, Epitaph had 20 different independent distributors to cover the world. In Australia and New Zealand, the partner was Shock Records. They would print up the CDs and get them into shops. They would tell radio and big chains about the band and make sure they sold as many as possible. Australian copies of Smash would have a Shock logo on them. Shock, a relatively new company, were no slouches. They had big success with albums such as ones by ex-Saints legend Ed Cooper that sold 10,000 copies. That was pretty big. The Offspring Smash would become the highest selling album of all time on an independent label. It sold 11 million albums. It went 6 times platinum in the US. In Australia, it sold 370,000 copies. That's 37 times Ed Cooper. It was difficult for Shock to just have that many CDs physically made. But they did it, and more. Shock Record had spent the years leading up to The Offspring setting themselves up for that success. That company banked on the indie side and were rightly rewarded. And they weren't the only ones. As the late 90s rolled around, a lot of bands signed to majors either failed or didn't make it. Shock, MDS and others would form an indie safety net that secured independent music's place in Australian culture. Welcome to Just Ace, a podcast about the 90s Australian alternative music scene, whatever the hell that means. This week, we look at Shock, its important in-house labels, the rise of indie distribution, and the formation of Air. There was just so much music being made in the 80s, far more than the major labels could scoop up. Around the world, there were thousands of independent labels and so much interesting music. The challenge was getting that music on a boat or a plane to get to Australia. And then, once they got here, to get them into stores that wanted them. As time goes by and every song ever made is a click away, it's hard to describe how hard it was to get a majority of music made in the world into Australia. Three friends and music collectors in Melbourne saw a gap in the market in 1988. They were Frank Falvo, Andrew McGee, and David Roy Williams. They all worked in music retail in some capacity. Falvo owned a record store in the suburb of Kew called Exposure Records. McGee had founded Greville Records. And Williams had worked in labels and distribution in the UK. And they had the idea that they could import a lot of these albums and sell them to stores faster and in bulk. And they called their business Shock. The trio pulled their money together to start the business. They were basically packing boxes day and night. They ordered them on a Friday in Australia, and because of time difference, they'd be on the desk of international labels before other countries could get in. The records would arrive as soon as the Monday, as close to the European release date as possible. Records would come in, and the three would send them off to Australian stores that ordered them. Their first warehouse was a bedroom in McGee's home. Early releases included cool international records that were hard to find. The very first label they signed up was the UK's Creation Records. In the late 80s, it was one of the coolest labels in the world, with bands like Primal Scream, Swerve Driver, and My Bloody Valentine. They would quickly sign up other cool labels like Rough Trade, Roadrunner, and SST, bringing in artists like PJ Harvey, Sepultura, and The Breeders. That was the level of records that weren't finding its way into Australian stores. By 1993, they picked up Beggar's Banquet, IRS, and so many more cool labels. Some stuff the labels didn't even have to send. Shock also offered to do local pressings of bigger titles. So there is an Australian pressing of the Creation Records release of Isn't Anything by My Bloody Valentine with a big Shock logo on the label. That way they could just keep the album in print with no delays. Shock had to rely on the growing indie network in Australia to get the word out about the records they had. But that network they relied on was becoming more reliable. There was the local street press and fanzines that might talk about the music they were sending out. Community radio was giving it a spin, and those indie record shops would order their albums. But the mainstream was still very far away. So they put on some promotion stuff around the country, and they started to act a little bit more like a record label. Shock also started distributing Australian music. It was just as hard to get Australian music around the country as it was for overseas releases. So they put out early work by Melbourne bands like The Fauves and Underground Lovers. They also had the Melbourne record label Agogo Records, who had early work by Spiderbait and Magic Dirt, Hot Records, who had older artists like Ed Cooper, Candle Records, with the Lucksmiths and the Simpletons, and this strange new band called Tism. A few things went Shock's way in the mid-90s. First, Waterfront closed down its distribution arm. Waterfront had been distributing some cool American and Australian labels into local stores, including Nirvana and Sub Pop. Shock bought Waterfront's distribution network, meaning they bought into the coolest alternative rock in a big way. Then in 1994, The Offspring released that album Smash. In Australia, it was a huge success and it was Shock Records' first ever number one album. It helped Shock secure their place as the seventh biggest music company in Australia, behind the Big Six major record labels. They followed it with a string of successes in 95 and 96. Dance and techno label Central Station Records licensed two singles from Europe that became Australian mainstream chart hits. Here's Johnny by Hocus Pocus and Nicky French's Total Eclipse of the Heart got to number one and number two in the singles chart. Tism's breakthrough 1995 album Machiavelli and the Four Seasons was released through Shock. It got to number eight in the Australian charts. And also in 1995, the influential label Ruart left Warner's and jumped to Shock. It was a short-lived deal, but it featured another number one album for Shock, UMI's 1996 album, Ali Daily. It would be Shock's first Australian number one album. Shock made $500,000 in their first year, and they were making over $17 million by the mid-90s. They grew as the scene grew. Shock had started mainly as a distributor. They were taking orders and driving trucks. But the thing about Shock was that they always had new ideas. They quietly started new businesses that made sense. They could do it because they were not owned by some multinational. And one of the most important was setting up a series of in-house labels. McGee had started his own label, separate to Shock, called Torn and Frayed in the early 90s. Shock distributed the label, which licensed some US stuff. Torn and Frayed released early albums by Dave Graney and the Coral Snakes, a year before they signed with the Polydor sub-label, Id. They also released the first album by the intriguing instrumental group, The Dirty Three, in 1994. But Shock could see a couple of interesting things happening in the market. One was bands were being scooped up by majors. Bands they distributed and they liked, such as Spiderbait and the Fauves, were leaving the indie scene and leaving Shock. Also, some great bands were still unsigned. There were more bands out there than the majors could have on. And finally, there were whole genres that major labels were ignoring. Punk and metal fans loved music, and the majors didn't really care for that stuff. So in the mid-90s, they decided to start in-house labels and sign bands directly. They started a label called Shock, but quickly realized that they should group bands by flavor, so the labels would have different names separate to the Shock brand. One of the first was a metal label called Thrust. Another was a local indie pop one called Concubine. Concubine released solo albums by two of the go-betweens, but their most successful in-house labels were the alternative rock and punk labels, in part because that was what was big in the 90s. The alternative rock label that they started was called the Hypnotized label. Two bands were on the label from the start. The first was a band from Sydney called Glide. Formed in 1991, they were fronted by singer and guitarist William Arthur. They released a couple of acclaimed EPs on their own, distributed by another indie distributor, MDS. They got a decent amount of Triple J airplay. There was major label interest in the band, but no deal ever felt right. So after some frustrating years, the band decided to go with Shock's new label instead. Their debut album was called Open Up and Croon, and it was released on the Hypnotized label in 1995. The album title comes from the opening track, a song about the labels who were interested in the band telling them how to be. It was produced by Paul McKercher as their first major statement. The crash of guitars sounds very 90s. Arthur wrote incredible songs of great power and yearning. Here's Glide with Why You Asking from their debut album Open Up and Croon.
Last night. Give it all for free. If you feel crippled by time that stretches out, bite into the apple and look and spit out. See into a life that could be spelled.
The other band to sign with the new label was Brisbane's Screamfeeder. Screamfeeder were a tight, fun three-piece that featured Tim Stewart on guitar and vocals, Kelly Lloyd on bass and vocals, and Dean Schwerab on drums from 1995 on. They mixed buzzy guitars with short, sharp pop songs and boy-girl vocals. Like Glide, they were not new. They had released two albums on Survival Records, a cool Sydney indie label that had been around since the 80s that Shock distributed. But Survival scaled back in the early 90s. So Screamfeeder's third album, 1995's Fill Yourself With Music, produced by Wayne Connolly, came out on the Hypnotized label. From that album, here's Screamfeeder with Lost in the Snow. It was around this time that the major labels were telling bands not to record so much. Make an album, get two or three songs on Triple J, tour all the time, do supports, then do your own tour, and make that last for 18 months or 2 years or even 3 years. Bands on major labels were getting more out of a single album. Why pay for another round of studio time? None of that concerned Shock. Both Glide and Screamfeeder followed up their 1995 albums with 1996 albums. Both albums were incredible. And funnily enough, the two bands swapped producers. Wayne Connolly would work with Glide, and Paul McKercher would work with Screamfeeder. Glide's 1996 album was called Disappear Here. Their first album was noisy and fierce, and Disappear Here had the energy, but it was more graceful. Here's the first single from Disappear Here. This is What Do I Know by Glide. For Screamfeeder, the 1996 album was called Kitten Licks, and it was a massive breakthrough for the band. The single Dart was a big hit on Triple J. How it didn't make the Hottest 100 of that year, I don't know, because the song was everywhere and everyone I knew loved it to death. I assume it's 101. Here's Dart by Screamfeeder. was wonderful. It's heartland Australian indie rock of the 90s. But the fact that Kitten Licks wasn't a top 5 album probably comes back to them being on Shock. As much as they could make and get a great record out to the indie fans in the indie record stores, they were working on a different level from the majors in terms of budget and reach. Kitten Licks was kind of a hard album for me to find. I was pretty good at getting everything, and I remember not being able to really find a copy of Kitten Licks. There wasn't 50 copies waiting for me at HMV, let alone any copies at Big W. They didn't make expensive looking film clips, and the clips they did make weren't all over TV, and they didn't have ads in heaps of music magazines. It's just those little things that take you to the top. It was just easier to hear about and find UMI, Regurgitator, and Spiderbait albums. Hypnotized also released one album by Sydney's Big Heavy Stuff. 1997's Maximum Sincere was out in the height of recovery where the band performed. It was a trashy indie rock classic with lots of Triple J singles. Here's one of those singles. This is May by Big Heavy Stuff. I should have known better. It wasn't just indie rock. Shock started an in-house label called Shagpile. It started in 1990 and they put out a few overseas releases and a few very small Melbourne punk bands. Many of them had fun dumb names like the Brady Bunch Lawnmower Massacre or Bored. By the second half of the 90s, Shagpile had a roster of some of Australia's best punk bands. The first to really break through was Sydney's Friends All Rom. They were a punk band that by 1996 had really hit their stride. They were fronted by Jason Wally with Ben Costello on guitar, Nat Nikiroig on drums, and Lex Feltham on bass. They had released one album themselves and before that, a notorious EP called Dick Sandwich. They were always fun in a juvenile way, which made them perfect for Triple J's young audience. They were all dressed colourfully and singer Jay's long dreadlocked hair seemed to change colour so often, it might have been between songs. Matched with being very tall and thin, he just didn't look like anyone else in music. Their debut for Shagpile was called Not So Tough Now, first released in 1996. It was set to be produced by Tony Cohen, hot from working with The Cruel Sea, Dave Graney, Paul Kelly and many more. But Cohen was unwell and was a drug addict. He didn't turn up to the studio very often and would kind of be in decline. Still, an album was salvaged. The lead single was Punch in the Face, which made it to number 72 in the Triple J Hottest 100 of 1996. Here's Punch in the Face by Friends All Wrong. Middle plan, wide, wide, trying hard to annoy. All we really need it is a ticket to ride. Fighting with the one and all, that's the guy we're gonna ball. Someone is as honest as it makes any cry. All we need is, 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 all we need is a punch in the face. Friends All Wrong and other punk bands benefited from the rise of the punk scene around the world, backed by the rise of an all-age circuit in Australia. After the death of Anna Wood, laws were changed for under-18s dance parties and people had to come up with a system to get kids through the door with higher restrictions. There was also some council and state government funding for all-age and regional gigs. Having done all that, many venues figured, what the hell, let's do under-18 indie and punk shows as well. It also helped that Triple J targeted teenagers and Recovery had an all-age gig guide every week. So a band like Friends All Wrong could play a lot. This included doing 2 shows in one day, an afternoon show for under-18s and a night show for the drinkers. Also, when big international punk bands came to Australia, Friends All Wrong had a good chance of getting the support slot. They released another 2 albums in quick succession on Shagpile. They had 1997's Meet the Family, which featured a slew of singles on Triple J. It was the first to feature new guitarist Lindsay McDougall, who everyone called The Doctor. Here's one of my favourites from that album, You Can't Move Into My House by Friends All Wrong. There's just a tiny bit of swearing in this one.
Hope you don't think I'm rude. Fuck you, hope you don't think I'm precious. Fuck you, hope you see I'm well adjusted. I can't stand the sight of you. I don't wanna be starting something. I don't wanna antagonize. All I said was something simple. I can't stand the sight of you. I can't stand the sight of you. Give a fuck, you're a fuck up, you're a joke. You're a clown, I'll take fans down. Then fuck you, fucking fuck me. You can't move into my house.
Then there's 1999's A Man's Not a Camel. It features new drummer Gordy Foreman. It would be their most successful chart placing so far, peaking at number 11 on the album charts. The single You Are Not My Friend made it to the ARIA charts at number 49, the closest they would get to a crossover hit. After four albums, thousands of shows, festivals like Warped, and several international tours, You Are Not My Friend earned the band an ARIA nomination for Best Breakthrough Single. They even performed at the ceremony. Here's You Are Not My Friend by Fenzel Rom. Another benefactor from this whole punk all-age scene was Melbourne's Body Jar, also on Shagpile. In this era, they were fronted by Cameron Baines on vocals and guitars, Ben Pedersen on vocals and guitar, Grant Ralph on bass, and Ross Hetherington on drums. Like Frenzel, they had spent years in the all-age circuit and supporting visiting punks like Blink-182 and NoFX. They also toured Japan, North America, and Europe. They released three albums on Shagpile between 1994 and 1998, the last of which, No Touch Red, was their big breakthrough. It was recorded in Montreal with Bill Stevenson and Stephen Egerton, both former members of The Descendants. Here's Body Jar with Remote Controller from their album No Touch Red. They also had a cover of Simon & Garfunkel's Hazy Shade of Winter, make number 36 in the Hottest 100 of 1999. Body Jar always did great covers of non-punk songs, including one of my favourites, a cover of They Might Be Giants' Your Race's Friend on an EP. Another band on Shagpile was Front End Loader. The Sydney band were fiery and exciting, but they weren't exactly California punk. They released their third album on Shagpile in 1999 called Last of the V8 Interceptors, produced by Magoo. It featured a big Triple J radio single called Pulse, which made it to number 72 in the Hottest 100 of 1997. Here's Pulse by Front End Loader. But my favourite band on Shagpile in the later era was Mac Pelican. There were three Japanese exchange students living in Perth who loved the Ramones and recorded an album. They wore leather jackets and you could barely understand what was going on. It is Pop Bliss. Their self-titled debut came out in 1999. Here's Mac Pelican with Dance in Chicago.
Nobody gonna kick piano.
That all-age punk scene was really indicative of shock. That scene was influenced by West Coast American bands and was a subgenre that the major labels simply didn't understand. Shock stepped in and supported those bands and made sure their albums were in shops. For the labels that Shock distributed, they mainly left it to them and the bands to do the publicity and manage their careers. For their in-house labels, they supported bands with modest amounts of money, but far from what the major labels were offering. Shock also helped these bands get overseas. They were importing a lot of music, but their partners started asking them about their Australian labels. Exporting Australian music was a key business for Shock in the late 90s. Making sure independent Australian albums went the other way became a multi-million dollar business. It supported bands like Frenzel and Body Jar, who were able to get overseas tours. Punk works all around the world, and you could buy Body Jar albums in Japan in the 90s. Shock weren't the only ones cashing in on the success of punk and the alternative movement. Another distributor in Melbourne was MDS, which stood for Mushroom Distribution Services. It was started in 1989 by Scott Murphy, and as the name suggests, it has ties to Mushroom Records. It was their way of helping developing bands or licensing the odd international album. It was a small operation, but in the early 90s they distributed Half a Cow, Citadel, and others. It was also a way for Mushroom to meet and work with up-and-coming talent. Frente released an early EP on MDS and ultimately signed to Mushroom. The Plums, featuring Carolyn Kennedy, would also have an MDS release before signing to Mushroom. The Plums had a minor hit in 1992 in indie circles with Au Revoir Sex Kitten, but the band would break up in 1995. Kennedy would go on to be the singer of Deadstar. Here's Au Revoir Sex Kitten by The Plums. By 1997, MDS scored two massive hits. First was the Whitlams' third album, Eternal Nightcap, released on the 8th of September 1997. It was released on the Whitlams' own Black Yak label, a sub-label of Phantom. A bit confusing, but ultimately it was distributed by MDS. It had already been preceded by a big single called No Aphrodisiac, and the album would end up making good on that single's promise. It would go gold and become one of the most acclaimed albums of the 90s. Here's No Aphrodisiac by The Whitlams.
A letter to you on a cassette, 'cause we don't write anymore. Gotta make it up quickly. There's people asleep on the second floor. There's no aphrodisiac like loneliness. Truth, beauty, and a picture of you.
And then 1 week later, on the 15th of September 1997, saw the release of a new EP by Melbourne punk band The Living End. They had started as a rockabilly covers band, but they started writing original material and joined the rich all-age punk scene. The release was on a label called Rapido, which had licensed some American punk into Australia. One of those albums was Blink-182's Dude Ranch, a big success for them. But The Living End's new EP would outshine that. It was called Second Solution / Prisoner of Society, and that second song in particular was a huge hit. Here's Prisoner of Society by The Living End.
I'm a brat, and I know
Those two came out 1 week apart, but they didn't crash the charts immediately. The releases built up and grew. Eternal Nightcap was still in the alternative charts 2 years later. It peaked in the ARIA chart at number 14 in April of 1998. The Living End single peaked at number 4 in the ARIA charts, but in June of 1998, 9 months after the initial release. But MDS was shut down in 1999 as part of a larger restructure of Mushroom. During that time, Sebastian Chase started his own distribution company. Chase had moved on from Ruart to run Phantom Records. His new company was called Metropolis Groove Merchants, or MGM Distribution, and it was founded in April of 1998. Phantom and the Whitlams would move over to the new venture when MDS folded. They would go on to be one of the major players in the next decade. Part of the success of MGM and independent music in Australia in the next decade and beyond was set up in the 90s, because 1996 saw the formation of the Association of Independent Record Labels, which they called AIR, although they would change their name to the Australian Independent Record Labels Association, which is better, and they still called it AIR. The idea of teaming up as an association meant it gave all these labels collective power, because it's easy to screw over someone when you're the nobodies signed to Nobody Records. But grouping together meant collectively you were a multi-million dollar business. So whether it was radio or retail, AIR could help the indies get a deal as a group. This would become so important in the next decade. These labels could group together and stand up to giants like Apple, Google, and Spotify. It started as just a meeting at the pub. Buying drinks were Sebastian Chase of Phantom, Graham Regan of Hot Records, industry expert and writer Ed Jonker, and entertainment lawyer Michael McMichael, the first AIR chairman. The first members included Phantom and Hot, as well as Shock. They also had labels from all over, like Sydney Indie Troy Horse, and metal labels like Warhead, and the record label run by the ABC. Phantom helped pay for the costs in the beginning, and an arts grant would ensure that it would last for a long time. AIR cost as little as $20 to join in those early years. They had 60 members by 1998 and 180 by the late 2000s. It wasn't hard to convince indie labels to join the cause. The belief when AIR started was that the independent scene had to work together to provide a different type of career path for artists. It was friendlier to non-mainstream genres and acts that wanted time to develop. Or acts that just didn't want to sell their rights and work to a major for whatever reason. They might just want to be more empowered. Or, as AIR would put it, you get paid for 6 albums instead of not being paid for your first. AIR could also work together to promote independent music to the world. As a group, they could go to music conferences and give Australian independent music a presence. They compiled Australian independent music samplers that they gave out to international music industry types at these trade shows. The early compilations featured bands like Glide, Screamfeeder, Body Jar, Big Heavy Stuff, Mac Pelican, Bernie Hayes, Diana Arnade, and many more. AIR would start their own chart for independent artists in 1998, one of their plans from the very start. They took over the Australian Music Report's own alternative and independent chart. The idea was to highlight Australian artists outside of the majors. Various alternative and indie charts had previously included bands like Green Day and Rage Against the Machine. Alternative and independent lost their distinction. This new AIR chart would be Australian artists and releases on independent labels. A retailer could pick up the AIR chart, which was sent to all stores, and order whatever the hell was at the top of the chart as an easy way to get into selling independent CDs. When I worked in retail in my little suburban CD store, I could use the AIR chart to justify to my boss that we should order some Whitlams and Friends of Rom. The charts were sent to these stores and radio stations, and they were printed in street press. They would follow it with further innovations like the AIR Awards and IndieCon, a yearly convention for independent music. They helped to make the indie sector a thriving industry in itself and an alternative career path to major label success. But in the late 90s, the majors did finally come calling for many of the acts in the indie world. The success of the Whitlams and the Living End didn't go unnoticed. Both those bands would sign new deals with major labels in 1998. Screamfeeder signed to a US label, Time Bomb, which was tied to major label BMG. Straight away there was a culture clash. They loved Kitten Licks and they wanted to release that album, but they wanted the band to have a bit more of a name first. So Screamfeeder waited and they weren't allowed to record a new album. Years were going by, so they recorded a number of standalone singles and an EP of covers called Home Age between 1997 and 1999. It's annoying that Screamfeeder weren't able to capitalize on Kitten Licks and record a follow-up because they were so hot at the time. One of the standalone singles from those lost years was the fantastic High Seas. Here's High Seas by Screamfeeder. High Seas is a wonderful song, and it also has a wonderful one-take film clip. The clip was oddly nominated for an MTV award. It's kind of complicated, but the American MTV Video Music Awards showed the nominees from all the international versions of MTV, and because this cheap one-take film clip from this indie band made the nominations, it got a bit of a mention in America. But they lost to Kylie Minogue. Kitten Licks was finally released in the US in 1999. 3 years later, with a different cover and track listing. Go figure. The album cover featured a dark photo of a tornado. I have no idea why. I kind of understand changing an album cover to have a photo of the band or something. This one just didn't seem to have a reason. I don't understand what it has to do with kittens. It wasn't a hit, and the band wanted to walk away, and it all went nowhere. Screamfeeder finally got to release the follow-up to Kitten Licks in 2000, 4 years after Kitten Licks came out. It was called Rocks on the Soul, and it was released on the Hypnotize label. From that album, here's the excellent Mr. Tuba. It's a song about a Sesame Street character, a tuba who doesn't listen to the rest of the band. Here's a clip from Sesame Street.
Listen here! Oh, stop! We sound even worse! Hey, Mr. Tuba!
But Mr. Tuba just continued to play.
I guess he doesn't hear ya. Well,
and here's Mr. Tuba by Screamfeeder. Screamfeeder seems to show no sign of stopping. They released a new album in 2022, and there was a 33 and a third book on Kitten Licks. There was a documentary about Screamfeeder released in 2023 called The Ending Goes Forever. Bodyjar signed to EMI in 2000. They actually put money into them and promoted the band. The first single, Not the Same, seemed to make a statement about how the band was still the same band. The wonderful film clip is set in a band audition, complete with some rich music exec, a recording contract the size of a phone book, and references to reality pop stars like Bardo. It also featured Sonic Animation for some reason. The album, How It Works, would be a career best, charting at number 19. Not the Same would make it to number 20 in the Hottest 100 of 2000. Here's Not the Same by Bodyjar.
You've changed. I don't need you anymore.
Works, the album would see a US release and the band joined the Warped Tour around America. They would have one more album on EMI and then they'd break up in 2009. Of course, like every other band though, they have since reformed and play shows. Frenzel Rom went to Sony in 2000. It was an ill-fated one-off where they were paired with an American producer. The band didn't get a big promo push and they were dropped after one album. But at least they didn't have to pay their advance back. They would actually end up on Epitaph before forming their own label. One of my favourite later Frenzel Rom songs is Russell Crowe's Band, which reached number 26 in the Hottest 100 of 2003 and equal career best. Here's Frenzel Rom with Russell Crowe's Band.
Don't get a million bucks for getting out of bed. Don't get a million bucks when I punch folks in the head. And even if we never get a Billboard Top 10 hit, at least we know the Russell Crowe Band's a fucking pile of shit.
Frenzel Rom would continue on. Notably, they would have an on-air argument with large dickhead Carl Sanderlands after an incident in Darwin, and Jane the Doctor would go on to be presenters on Triple J Breakfast. They released their latest album, The Cup of Pestilence, in 2023. But the end of the 90s saw punk also get co-opted by the major labels all around the world, not just Australia. The signing spree of alternative rock in the early 90s was replicated by the punk scene in the late 90s. The Offspring themselves would sign to Sony. Blink-182 would sign to Universal. Bands with little experience like Sum 41 and Bowling for Soup would sign big deals. The song starts again, once more from the top. But on the other hand, The Fooves, who were dropped by Polydor, came back to Shock and released the album Thousand Yard Stare in 2000 through the Hypnotized label. Thousand Yard Stare is a term that suggests the trauma that the band had been through. Being dropped by a major label at this time usually meant that you'd break up. The Fooves had Shock as a safety net and they released several albums on that label. From Thousand Yard Stare, here's Give Up Your Day Job.
Take a chance, take romance, looking fancy in the pants. You can give up your day job, what you see. You can be with your reconstructed knee. Cop a plea, come on, give up your day job. Come on, give it up, your day job.
Every 2 minutes long, not a day job. Ooh, 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 yeah, yeah. Ding now, facing the world.
Very sadly, William Arthur of Glide died in 1999, aged just 34. Glide barely reached their promise. Shortly after his death, they released a collection of unreleased Glide songs called Last. The opening track was very different to Glide, and it was a poppy piano song. It's a gorgeous little song called Baby Now. Here's Baby Now by Glide.
One confection I forgot to mention. Glad you made it. You don't need to say it. You made my number. If you wanna call me, yeah. And I remember what your friend said. She's only 19, but I'll take good care of her. She bites her lip and kills her.
For Shock, those in-house labels were just part of their business. The late 90s saw so much more success and they weren't snobby about the genre. They scored big with compilations from Dance Station Wild FM. They got to number one in the singles chart in 1998 with Jennifer Page's pop song Crush. They also had British R&B star Craig David, whose debut album would peak at number two at the ARIA Albums Chart. They were making around $17 million a year in the mid-90s, and in 1999 they made $40 million. the rise of the Australian independent music scene follows in parallel with the rise of Shock. They would expand into DVDs and that export business would grow. They continued to support Australian music in a big way. They would be pioneers on the internet and be one of the first companies in Australia to offer paid downloads. And in the ultimate turn, the major labels approached Shock about a buyout. But Shock didn't need the money, they were fine. After a while, all the founders left and physical media died because you stopped buying stuff. Shock was sold to a CD duplication company in 2010 and it was never the same. That company, Regency Media, went bankrupt in 2023. The Offspring Smash had 20 different international indie distributors, and when Shock collapsed around 2021, they were the only one in that 20 still going. There's no great overview of this scene because it kind of wasn't a scene. They were just a bunch of indie artists who grouped together. There were some Shock label samplers, but that really isn't the place to start. And because they didn't sign major label contracts that forced them to, very few of the bands even have greatest hits. Screamfeeder have a collection, but otherwise, it's just a lot of great albums. Glides Disappear Here, Frenzel Rom's 90s work, Big Heavy Stuff's Maximum Sincere, Mac Pelican's debut, and many more. I'll list them on the site. The bands all have some ownership of the records. A couple of them have turned up on vinyl. I hope they all do. Every so often, someone runs a survey of young bands or music students or something and asks them what they want. And inevitably, they all say, sign to a major label. Which is fine. Lots of my favourite artists were on major labels. The goddamn Clash were on a major label. You think you're better than the Clash? Because you're not. But the indie sector is important. It plays a lot of roles. They provide a place for bands to find themselves before jumping to a major, and giving them time to find out who they are. Spiderbait, The Living End, and The Whitlams all knew what they were doing by the time they signed on the dotted line to a major label. The indies also give a place for subcultures and subgenres that labels don't care about to thrive, like dance, punk, and metal. They're also there to catch you if it all goes wrong with your big label. Like what happened to The Fauves, Frenzel Rom, Tism, or Screamfeeder. Shock really led the pack here and played all those roles. Distributor, pressing plant, exporter, label, and safety net. That Shock and the indie scene as a whole could be so many things to so many people is why it's so important that that indie scene thrives. There has to be an alternative. But the thing to really say about all this is that alternative and independent got all mixed up at the start of the 90s, but then alternative died off. And the corduroy pants and the Chuck Taylors got put away, and I stopped wearing long-sleeve t-shirts under a short-sleeve t-shirt. But independent didn't die with alternative. The gains that the independent music scene made on the back of the alternative movement remained. Shock led the way for indie distribution in the next decade, and they were joined by MGM, Inertia, Remote Control, and others. All of them would fall under the Air umbrella. Artists like John Butler would have 4 number one albums through the independent system in the next couple of decades. The Australian hip-hop scene was built on the back of it. Thousands of Australian artists benefited from this independent scene. This strong independent foundation that was founded in Australia in the 90s continues to this day. To end, some music. I love Frenzel Rom, and from that mega successful 1999 album, A Man Is Not a Camel, here's my favourite single from it, Never Had So Much Fun. It was definitely one of the names considered for this podcast, and it would have worked nicely. Here's Frenzel Rom with Never Had So Much Fun.
I smoked a pack of cigarettes before midday. I coughed up a lung around 1. I can't see a thing through my eyes that sting. I can't remember having so much fun. Well, I've never had so much fun. No, I've never had so much fun. I can't remember when I've ever had so much fun.
Thanks for listening to this episode of the Just Ace podcast. This is the end bit, where I talk about how you can support the podcast. This week I want to highlight just a very simple way you can help the podcast, and the book for that matter, and that's just telling a friend or two. It's more than just a favour. It's actually the number one way that people discover and like new things. It's when a friend recommends it. And I see it. The world is so noisy. But when someone I know says I might like something, it means so much more. That organic spreading of the word is really where it's at. Telling your friends on social media, sharing links to the podcast, that all helps as well. But just in conversation, just think of that friend that you have that you think might like this and let them know. That's all it takes. It might be small for you, but it all adds up for me. And I know a lot of people have done this already. I've never taken out an ad for the podcast or anything. Every listener, I guess, is pretty much all word of mouth, so thank you. There's other ways to support me as well, like the Patreon or the tipping service Buy Me a Coffee. And there's the new book, the number one Amazon bestseller in a minor category, the Just Ace book, which adapts the first two seasons. And there's a merch store on Redbubble for you to buy t-shirts and tote bags. Don't forget to leave me reviews on Apple Podcasts or Amazon, or follow me on socials, or check out the website. There's so much that you can do, and all the links are in the description. That's it. Next week, teenagers led the alternative charge in Australia in the 90s. But what if you didn't fit in with the kids?
Hi, this is Ben.
And this is Sam.
We've got a podcast called Oz Rock Rated.
We take our favourite Australian bands' catalogues
and we rank them worst to best, according to us.
So if you're a fan of Oz Rock,
join us wherever you get your podcasts.